4, and the time is now 10:16. We're joined today by Representative Armstrong, Representative Shragi, Representative Brox, Representative McKay, Representative Baker, and myself. I'm Chair Rauscher. I don't see any other legislators in the room right now. I also would like to take a moment to thank our House Record Secretary, Gail Brown, and our LIO moderator, Talia Ames. All right. And my committee aide, Craig Valdez, for all that they do for this committee. Before we begin, I'd like to remind everybody to silence your cell phones, all your electronic gear. If anybody has a question in the audience, they can address it through the chair. Any answers from those testifying, likewise, go through the chair back to the representatives here at the committee. And anybody needs to pass a note back and forth, you can contact my staff, committee aide, Craig Valdez. So today we're going to hear from Ms. Samantha Owen, Senior Regulatory Consultant at McMillan Incorporated. Ms. Owen will be giving us a presentation regarding the Eklutna Hydro Fish and Wildlife Program. With Ms. Owen today for technical questions is Tony Zellers, Chief Operating Officer at Matanuska Electric Association Incorporated, and Andrew Laughlin, Chief Operating Officer at Chugach Electric Association, both of which are online today. Ms. Owen, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
We can hear you. So if you would, please place your name on record, give us your affiliation, and you can begin your testimony.
Yes, my name is Samantha Owen. I work for McMillan, and we have been contracted by the owners of the hydroelectric project to assist them with the implementation of the 1999 agreement as it pertains to the Eklutna hydroelectric project. I am going to go ahead and share my screen. And let me know when you guys can see that.
Yes, we can. Thank you.
Great. Perfect. All right. I am going to first take a little bit of a step back and make sure we all know, you know, what we're talking about, why we're talking about it, and so then we'll take a more of a deep dive into some of the details. But first, if you haven't been there before, the Eklutna Watershed, it's located about 30 miles northeast of Anchorage, and it provides a lot of different benefits for the community. Most of you are probably more aware of it as a popular recreational site within Chugach State Park, but it also provides 90% of the public water supply for the city of Anchorage, and there is a hydro project out there. The dam is located just downstream of the lake outlet and isn't visible to most visitors, but it's there, and it is part of the overall hydro project that has a powerhouse about 4.5 miles north of here. So I'm going to go through a map here in just a second to get us all oriented. But first, we're going to focus in on the hydro project itself. As stated, it's owned and operated by Chugach Electric, Matanuska Electric, and the municipality of Anchorage. It provides about 24% of Chugach's renewable portfolio and about 45% of Matanuska's renewable portfolio. It's used and maximized during cold spells for potential gas supply emergencies. It offsets approximately 86,000 tons of carbon every year. It's the lowest cost energy source in South Central Alaska, and it can be used to regulate other future renewables like wind and solar. So here's that map I was talking about, and hopefully you guys can see my pointer here. I'm going to take a second to orient all of us. So Eklutna Lake is down here in the bottom right-hand corner. If you go out to Eklutna Lake, the state park, you're likely out here by the campground area. There's also the Eklutna Lakeside Trail, which has a reservoir up on the northeast side of the lake over here. But where is the hydro project? So it's represented by these red dots. The dam itself is right here, again, just downstream of the natural lake outlet. The intake is about a mile as the crow flies northeast of the dam on the absolute north end of the lake. It leads to a 4.5 mile tunnel, which is this white line here, to the powerhouse over on the Knik River. And once water is pushed through the powerhouse, through turbines, and we generate electricity with it, the water is discharged into the tail race up here. This tail race is a pretty popular recreational fishery that is stocked with chinook and coho by Fishing Game. There's also a defunct hatchery out here, but this hatchery hasn't been in operation since the 90s. Other infrastructure in the area, you might see these purple dots. There was actually a historic or an older hydro project built in the 1920s by a private entity, and that had a dam right here at the actual lake outlet for additional storage. But then there was a bigger diversion dam down here in the what we call the canyon reach of the river, so 60-foot tall concrete arch dam. This dam was recently removed back in 2018 by the Native Village of Akutna, Akutna Inc., and the Conservation Fund. So that dam is no longer there. But if you remember hearing about the Akutna Dam removal, that was this dam, not here, right here, not our dam that we're going to be talking about today. Other infrastructure in the watershed, this black line right here is a second tunnel. We call this the Awu Tunnel. It actually utilizes the same exact intake as the hydro project. But then shortly after the intake, about 10% of the water is diverted through the Awu Tunnel for public water supply purposes. And that 10% of water from the lake is what represents the 90% of water for the city of Anchorage. The tunnel daylights here about a mile downstream of the dam at a facility we call the Awu Portal Valve. It transitions into a buried pipeline, and that pipeline is buried for about 6 miles underneath or adjacent to the Akutna River before it pops out of the valley and goes to the Awu Water Treatment Plant. And this is where the water is treated before it's piped down to the city of Anchorage itself. Other stuff shown on this map, we have downstream infrastructure, including the Old Glenn Highway, New Glenn Highway bridges, and the railroad bridge, and then, of course, the native village of Akutna itself. So I'm going to take a second to go over how the reservoir is operated for the hydro project. And this is a bunch of colorful lines. And what do they mean? Well, this is how this is the lake levels of the reservoir for every year for the past 23 years or so. And you can see that there are some differences from year to year, but it follows a pretty general curve, right? This is showing a water year, not a calendar year. So we're starting in June, going through May. And you can see that the reservoir is at its lowest point every year in the May-June timeframe. And then it starts to increase rapidly through the spring and the summer before it reaches its max water level in about September-ish. And why is that? So Akutna functions as a storage hydro project, which means we are storing water that's captured throughout the spring runoff and the summer glacial melt. We store that in the reservoir, and then we actually use it throughout the year. So the goal is for the owners to draw the reservoir down low enough throughout the fall and the winter that by the time the weather shifts in, you know, May, June-ish timeframe, and all the snow starts to melt and the glacier starts to melt and we start to get higher inflows to the lake, we've created enough storage in the reservoir that we can capture all of that water without spilling any of it, ideally. Some years we do spill, and so you can see the 870-871 is about the spillway crest. So anytime we're getting above this line here was likely a spill event. But for the most part, the project owners are very successful with managing the reservoir to maximize hydro production. And here is a aerial photo showing the dam itself. So the dam is this linear feature right here. It's an earth and rock fill dam, and it has a concrete spillway going through the middle of it. This photo was taken in May or June, so in the spring of 2022, I believe. And that's when the reservoir was at its lowest point that year. So you can see that the dam actually is not holding back any water at this point in time. We do have a little pond that forms right here, And if you remember, I was talking about that old storage project, our old hydro project that had a storage dam right here at the lake outlet. The remnants of that old dam and on top of the natural lake outlet form this little pond right here most of the year whenever the lake has been drawn below that elevation. But for about 9 months out of the year, the lake is below this point, and the dam actually isn't holding back much water. So at the beginning of this project, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, we were getting a lot of questions about the feasibility of providing water from the lake into the river. And this is really one of the main challenges when we were looking at this assessment, is that there actually isn't water at the dam most of the year. And that's because the reservoir is operated as a storage hydro project. So it's really fundamental to understand that in order to understand a lot of the conversations we were having around alternatives analysis. And here is a timeline showing a lot of the development that happened in the Acutna watershed. The purpose of this timeline is to show that, there's a lot of other stuff happening there that had its own environmental impacts. And so one of our challenges as we were starting this process was to really differentiate between what were the impacts of the current hydro project and what were the impacts of some of the other stuff that was going on in the basin. And I'll summarize it quickly just to say that back in 1914, that's when the U.S. Congress authorized construction of the Alaska Railroad, and that's really the first development that we started to see in the watershed. 1929 is when that first hydroelectric project was built on the Acutna River by the private entity. 1935 is when the Palmer Highway was constructed, now known as the Old Glenn Highway, and we still have a bridge crossing at that location. 1955 is when the federal government finished construction of the current hydro project, the one we're talking about today. 1960s is actually when the Army was out there for a few years. They were using the Acutna Glacier to do glacier training for the Army, and that's where the Lakeside Trail comes from. That used to actually be an old Army road so that they could get out to the Acutna Glacier. And then once the state park was established about a decade later, it was converted into a recreational trail. 1965 is actually when the Acutna Dam was replaced after the 1964 earthquake. So the dam that we're looking at today was actually built in 1965, even though the project itself was built about a decade earlier. Again, 1970 is when the Chugach State Park was established, and that's when the railroad began gravel mining in the river below the railroad bridge. In 1975 is when we see the New Glenn Highway be constructed. 1988 is when the Acutna Water Project, so that public water supply infrastructure, was all constructed. And then that brings us to 1989, is when the federal government said, hey, we're looking to sell Acutna. They were also looking to sell Snettisham at the same time, which is what provides about 65 to 70% of the power generation out there in Juneau. Both of those projects were sold at the same time by the federal government for the Acutna projects, the three local utilities, which at the time was MLMP, Chugach Electric, and Matanuska Electric, said, hey, we'll buy it. And they actually signed the purchase agreement in 1989. And it wasn't until after this purchase agreement was signed that some folks raised concerns about the project's impacts to fish and wildlife. And that's what ultimately led to the Fish and Wildlife Agreement, which was signed in 1991. It's important to note that Congress didn't actually authorize the sale of the project until 1995, and then it wasn't actually sold to the utilities until 1997. And this is what we refer to as the transaction date. And that'll be important later. 1998 is when Fish and Game starts stocking the Acutna Tail Race with Chinook and Coho. And then 2016 is when the Old Glenn Highway Bridge was replaced. So anyone who's been out to that area, if you've done the hike out to Thunderbird Falls, that parking lot right there is right next to the Old Glenn Highway Bridge. And that's the bridge we're talking about, which was replaced here in 2016. And then that leads us all the way to 2018, when that lower dam was removed by the conservation fund, the Acutna Inc., in the native village of Acutna. Okay. So that 1991 Fish and Wildlife Agreement, what does it say and what does it require? It says a lot, but I'm going to focus in on some of the more substantive requirements. First, It required the project owners to conduct a study program, and there were four main requirements associated with that. And I call this the four-step process. First, we had to examine and quantify, if possible, the impacts to fish and wildlife from the federal equipment project. Two, we had to examine and develop proposals for the protection, mitigation, and enhancement of fish and wildlife affected by the project. Three, we had to consider how those fish and wildlife measures might impact other stuff, including electric ratepayers, municipal water utilities, recreational users, and adjacent land use. And then four, available means to mitigate those impacts. So you can think of it as mitigating your mitigation in a way. And then the other substantive requirement from the 1991 agreement is that once the project owners develop a proposed program, that gets submitted to the governor, and then the governor is going to be the one to issue a final program. And when he does that, he has to take these eight things into consideration. One, purposes of efficient and economical power production. Two, energy conservation. Three, the protection, mitigation, and enhancement of fish and wildlife. Four is the protection of recreational opportunities. Five, municipal water supplies. Six, preservation of other aspects of environmental quality. Seven is a nice other bucket, other beneficial public uses. And then eight is the requirements of state law. So we started this process about 5 years ago, went through a comprehensive study planning process with all stakeholders, including the agencies listed in the agreement itself, but also other NGOs or entities and the tribe itself who were just interested in the project. We went through a year one study planning and then year one study implementation, and then we came back for year two study planning and year two study implementation. I won't belabor the details of our 2 year study program, other than just to say we studied everything we could think of. So we did an in-stream flow study. We looked at a passage barrier analysis in the canyon reach. We built a sediment transport model and looked at geomorphology in the river. We did our own salmon surveys, looking at what salmon were currently using the river and where they were spawning. The Native Village of Aquitna did their own salmon surveys, and we coordinated with them weekly on this effort. We looked at fish in the lake, looking for how the existing fish in the lake were doing, what the existing habitat in the lake might be, looking at IHN in the lake and in the existing kokanee population, all that good stuff. We looked at water quality in the lake. We did our own wetland survey. We did a wildlife study. We did a recreation survey. We looked at cultural resources. We built out an operations model for the reservoir in order to look at various alternative operating scenarios and how that might impact generation and carbon offsets. And then finally, we did a bunch of engineering to evaluate all the different potential engineering solutions and PME measures that were being brought forward by several of the stakeholders in the stakeholder group. So once we did that, we completed our comprehensive study program. We kicked off an alternatives analysis early last year with the stakeholders who were interested in participating. That included several of the signatories to the 1991 agreement itself, including the Department of Natural Resources, NOAA Fisheries, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, and Fish and Game. But we also had folks like Trout Unlimited, Aquitna Inc., ALU, the Anchorage Water and Wastewater Utility, Native Village of Aquitna, and the Conservation Fund participating as well.
So, Ms. Owen?
Yes.
I was wondering, what kind of fish are in the lake?
Oh, great question. So there are a couple different species, but the one that you will hear talked about the most is the existing kokanee population. I'm actually going to go back a couple slides. And that's these guys right here. You may say, are those juvenile kokanee? Well, actually, no. These are the adult kokanee that are in Aquitna Lake right now. And you can see these are actually spawned out kokanee. There are little salmon eggs next to them, verifying that these were adults. This does not look like an adult kokanee. That's because the population of kokanee in Aquitna is very unique. They're much smaller than they should be. They're not showing sexual dimorphism, or varying the coloration that they should be showing. They only have a handful of eggs each instead of the, you know, hundreds or thousands of eggs that they should be having. And I think this is indicative of the fact that there's just a low nutrients in the lake, which we confirmed during our water quality study. There's not much for these guys to eat up there. And that is due to a couple different factors. One being the nutrients itself, but also the high turbidity of the lake isn't supporting good primary production in the lake itself.
And one more question. That's not a stocked lake, is it?
It is not a stocked lake currently. We looked at all of the old stocking records, and there were a couple instances back in the 80s and 90s where some fish were stocked in the lake by fishing game, but that stocking program has not continued to the present day.
And one more question. That's a very high silt content lake. Is that correct?
It is. It is a glacially fed lake. About 85% of the inflows to the lake are coming from Akutna Glacier. So, it looks like any other glacially fed lake in Alaska, that beautiful turquoise color. But yes, it has extremely high sediment loads and turbidity, and isn't, which means that the light can't penetrate the water column very far. And that's what's, we think, one of the primary reasons for the lack of primary production. And if you don't have primary production, you don't have secondary production, and there's nothing for the fish to eat.
Oh, well, thank you. Any other questions? Then please continue, Ms.
Absolutely. Okay. So our alternatives analysis, what did that look like? That was a series of about 5 meetings, and that went from April through August of last year. It was a pretty iterative process. Participants were asked to submit a comprehensive alternative or alternatives. We received, I think, 36 or 39 alternatives at one point. We took all of those alternatives and ran them through our models. I'll clarify that an alternative was a combination of infrastructure and flow regime. So you could have, several alternatives that were using the same infrastructure, but maybe you requested a different flow regime for each. And we ran all of those through the models, including our operations model, our in-stream flow models, our sediment transport model, came back at the next meeting and presented to the results for each alternative to everybody, gave people an opportunity to tinker with their alternatives, resubmit. We re-ran things through the model, re-presented results, did this about 2 or 3 times, and then at the end of the alternatives analysis, we asked people to submit their preferred alternatives based on all the results that had been presented. So here's what the results of all of that was. This is everyone's preferred alternative, and this is showing the cost side of the equation. I'm sure you are familiar with cost-benefit analyses. This slide shows the cost. The next slide I'm going to show is going to show the benefits. And there's a lot of information here, so I'll try to walk you through it. Each of these represents a preferred alternative that was selected by one of the stakeholders, and who is associated with each alternative is shown here on the bottom. The costs are broken down into 3 different categories. I'll use this first category is the dark gray, I guess is what you would call this color, is the CapEx costs. The blue is the replacement energy costs. So if you remember, I said Akutna is currently the lowest cost energy source in South Central Alaska. If water goes down the river for fish, it cannot go to the powerhouse, which means there's a reduction in generation. The demand isn't going anywhere, so that generation will need to be replaced with something else. Currently, the only thing they could replace it with is natural gas, and so this is showing what it would cost to replace that generation with natural gas. And then the orange is increased O&M costs. So if you're building new infrastructure, then you have increased O&M and maintenance activities every year, and there is a cost associated with that. And we've lined them up from most expensive to least expensive, and everything kind of fell into about 4 buckets, 3 or 4 buckets, depending on how you look at it. First, we had the replacement dam alternative, and I'll explain what that is a little bit later. We had an alternative where we release water from the existing dam, either with or without a fish ladder. And then we had something called the AWU portal valve alternative, which is, again, I'll explain more about that in just a second. But you can kind of see where everyone was falling and how these different alternatives line up against each other as far as costs are concerned. We have the all-in cost shown here at the top of each bar. So that's over a 35-year period. Why 35 years? Going back to the 1991 Fish and Wildlife Agreement, it requires the owners to repeat this process every 35 years. So this Fish and Wildlife Program will be good for the next 35 years. Then they have to come back, go through the process again, and we'll get a new Fish and Wildlife Program. So we've added up the cost over a 35-year period. And then in order to compare apples to apples, we annualize that cost. And that's what's shown over here on the left-hand side. So you're seeing that each of these alternatives range from something in the, range of about $3 to $4 million per year to as much as $24 million per year. And then the last thing I'll point out on this slide is this red line that's going across the middle of the graph. This represents the Acutna net production cost benefit. What does that mean? That means if we went up to the Acutna powerhouse today and just turned it off, not necessarily decommissioned it, but just turned off the powerhouse and replaced all of that generation with something else, what would that cost us? And the answer is about $18.7 million a year. So this is just one way of looking at the value of Acutna Hydro. And you can see that some alternatives are more expensive and some alternatives are less expensive than that number. So that was the cost. Here's the benefits of everyone's alternative. Again, we have all of the alternatives lined up here on the left-hand side, all the preferred alternatives for each stakeholder. And then we're showing the habitat gains in acres by species and by life stage. So this goes back to that in-stream flow model that we had developed. And basically what that model does is it says, if I put this much water in the river, how much habitat am I going to be creating for each species at each life stage? We looked at three different species, including Chinook, Coho, and Sockeye, and then we looked at two different life stages, spawning and rearing. And this is showing how much habitat would be gained under each scenario. And you can see it ranges from a few acres of habitat gains in some cases. For spawning habitat, we're in the range of, 1.5 to 5 acres of habitat gains. Some of these with more habitat gains, it's because they included fish passage and it allows the fish to access additional habitat above the dam. Rearing habitat, we're looking at much bigger numbers, and so we're ranging from about 6 acres to 28 acres, 30 acres in some cases, depending on the alternative. So at the end of the alternatives analysis, the hydro project owners stepped away, considered all the information that was presented, made some hard decisions, and put out a draft Fish and Wildlife Program at the end of October last year. So what was included in that draft and why? And then I'm going to review that here. And then I'll also review what was not included in the draft and why. To summarize what was included, we had year-round base flows in the river, periodic channel maintenance flows. The purpose of this is to basically help keep the gravels clean in some way, right? Salmon are very picky about what gravel they like to spawn in. And so in a natural system, you'll see a flush of water or a peak flow come down the river every now and then during like a flood event. This has a really important ecological process associated with it. It helps to flush out all the fine sediments in order to keep those gravels nice and clean, but it shouldn't be so big that it takes all the good spawning gravel with it. So there's a real balance there that you want to try and strike, and it should match your base flow regime. We also have new AMU bridges are proposed in the draft program, and I'll explain a little bit more about that later. And then there's also a monitoring and adaptive management plan. So I'm going to go through each one of these in more detail. The photo that I'm showing here on the right-hand side is actually a photo from our study flow releases. So in order to develop that in-stream flow model I was just talking about, we actually had to put some water in the river in order to take measurements, looking at depth and velocity and substrate under various flow scenarios. And so this is a photo of water coming down the Acutna River. And you can see that in the upper river, this is what the riverbed looks like right now. It's pretty dry for a few miles. And here we are. This is our 2021 study flow releases. Okay, So base flows in the river. There are two things associated with that. First, it's how are we going to put water in the river? And second is how much water are we proposing to put in the river? The project owners are proposing that we utilize the existing ARU infrastructure to get water into 11 out of 12 miles of the Aquitana River. So this is the quote-unquote ARU portal valve alternative. And if you remember going all the way back to that map I showed at the beginning of the presentation, there was a tunnel that teed off from the power tunnel and went for about a mile and daylighted about a mile downstream of the dam itself. And that's where the ARU portal valve is located. It's where the tunnel transitions into the buried pipeline. We are proposing to use the excess capacity in this tunnel that ARU is never going to be able to utilize because of the restrictions of some of the other downstream infrastructure, and build an additional release valve here in order to put water into the river at this location. So again, this gets water into about 11 out of 12 miles of the Aquitana River. And one of the main reasons the project owners are proposing this option is that it continues, it lets them continue to operate the reservoir as a storage reservoir, right? They can continue to bring the reservoir down throughout the fall and the winter, creating storage to capture inflows that would be coming in the spring and the summer. And so this has a pretty minimal impact to their operations. So how much water are we proposing to put in the river? We are proposing about 40 CFS to be released during the summer. And this should benefit all four species of salmon that are currently spawning in the Aquitana River. Someone might say, why do you say four species? I've heard five species. I say four species because sockeye currently are not spawning in the river. We did 2 years worth of spawning surveys coordinated with the native village of Aquitana. Neither team over those 2 years observed any sockeye spawning in the river. So we did observe Chinook, Coho, Pinks and Chums, all of them utilizing the lower Aquitana River. And this 40 CFS, we think, would benefit all four of those species. So what is this graph? What am I showing here? Like I said, we built out the in-stream flow model for both Chinook and Coho. That was agreed to by the stakeholders as priority species. And this is showing how much water is released from the portal valve over down here on the bottom of the chart. And then on the left-hand side is showing habitat gains in acres. So you can see that with the pretty minimal flow releases coming from the ARU portal valve, that first 20, 30, 40 CFS or so, we start to see a lot of habitat gains throughout the river. And then we reach something of an inflection point around here, and you can add more water, but you don't get as much habitat gains. And then actually you get to a point where more water is actually not better. And this is because you'll start to see much higher velocities in the river, and which actually is not good for salmon spawning. And so there is a sweet spot around here, and we think we've hit it with the 40 CFS. And the other rationale for 40 CFS goes back to that passage barrier analysis. There is a canyon reach in the river, and there were some questions raised about is there a minimum flow that might be needed for fish to get through that canyon reach, specifically associated with some rock falls in the area. Did any of those rock falls pose a fish passage barrier? The long story short is that about 40 CFS is what would be needed for fish to get past those rock falls in the canyon. So 40 CFS achieves two different objectives here. It creates a good amount of habitat for a reasonable amount of water, and it also allows the fish to get through the canyon to access that habitat in the upper river.
Well, Ms. Owen, we have a question from Representative Shragi.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Rauscher, and through the chair. Do we have a good understanding of the species of salmon that have historically spawned in the Aquitana River?
That's a great question. We have traditional ecological knowledge from the village that says all five species of salmon were spawning in the Aquitana River. To my knowledge, there's no real quantification of how many salmon might be using the river, let's say pre-1920s, when that first hydro project was constructed. the only study that I am aware of that tried to quantify it in some way was actually looking at sediment deposits in the reservoir. And this study was not done by us. It was done by another group of people about 10 years ago or so. And they looked at sediment cores in the lake. The idea here is that you can almost use them like tree rings. You can count back to 1929 and then look at pre and post 1929 and compare the sediment deposits. And what they were looking for was what's called marine-derived nutrients. So the idea here is that the salmon obviously return to the ocean as part of their life cycle. They acquire these marine-derived nutrients, and then when they come back to the river systems or back to the lakes for spawning, and they spawn, they rear, and then they die, and then they sink to the bottom, and they take those marine-derived nutrients with them. So theoretically, you should be able to see a distinction between marine-derived nutrients. Now, we know that the old dam, the 1929 dam that was constructed in the lower river, cut off any kind of migration into the lake at that time. And so there was a desire to see if we could see a real difference between marine-derived nutrients pre and post-1929. And the short answer is no. They could not find any evidence showing through the marine-derived nutrient study of a salmon run in the Kootenai Lake pre-1929. That said, they did a sensitivity analysis and said, okay, how many salmon could have gotten into the lake without triggering the marine-derived nutrient signature? And the answer was about 1,000, maybe up to 15,000. So I think that's the best answer I can give you.
Follow up, if I may.
Representative, go ahead.
Or, you know, just thinking about this, I know that I suspect the reason this presentation is before us today is there's some controversy around the various plans that are being put forward. And I think it's just important to recognize that I think one of the central concerns around the various plans is the native village of Aklutna feels very strongly that historically they have had red salmon runs, and potentially up to 15,000 could have been in the lake without, evidence being evidenced through that marine deposit study. So I just, not a question, but a comment. I think that's something that is relevant to the discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Shragi. Any other comment to his comment? Otherwise, you can go ahead with your presentation.
That's great. Thank you. So that was the summer flows. What are we proposing for winter flows? Answer is 27 CFS. And this is based off of a winter flow analysis that we conducted as part of a study program. The idea here is to promote favorable ice conditions in the winter for winter rearing habitat. What are favorable ice conditions? Well, surface ice is good and anchor ice is bad, right? Surface ice actually insulates the river and creates a nice cozy environment for the salmon to survive the winter. But anchor ice actually forms in between the gravel itself and will lead to potentially freezing the river from the bottom up. And that's just, it's not good for salmon. It'll freeze out the reds. There's no interstitial spaces for the salmon to hide over the winter. And so that's what we don't want. We built out a model and went out and did some coring of the river itself during the winter a couple of years ago, looking at ice conditions in order to calibrate that model. And what the model is showing is about right here, you know, this flow range is what would promote good ice conditions, we believe, in the winter over throughout the river. So that's the, 30 to 40 CFS range, 30 to 50 CFS range. By releasing 27 CFS from the dam in combination with what's coming out of Thunderbird Creek, we think we're going to be in this ballpark, and we'll have good ice conditions in the winter for rearing salmon. So that was the base flows. We're also proposing periodic channel maintenance flows in the river, and this is, again, to help maintain that spawning habitat over time, right? Clean the gravel without washing all of it out. So we ran different scenarios through our sediment transport model, and ultimately we're proposing about 220 CFS and 3 out of every 10 years to accompany our base flow regime. We're going to utilize the existing drainage outlet gate at the dam in combination with the AV portal valve in order to provide these flows. The flows will occur during the fall, and we're also proposing to shape the peak flow so that we don't accidentally strand fish downstream. What do I mean by that? You can see that the flow would actually ramp up pretty quickly initially. We'd hold it at 220 CFS for an extended period of time, and then we'd ramp down relatively slowly. And this is consistent with U.S. Fish and Wildlife requirements so as not to bring the water level down too quickly and accidentally strand fish in side channels on the shoreline of the river so that they have time to get back into deeper parts of the river. We've also included a monitoring and adaptive management plan as part of the program, and this will allow us to adaptively manage and improve habitat over time. First things first, we're proposing to establish a committee. This would include the parties to the 1991 agreement itself and the Native Village of Akutna. It would exclude the project owners. So this would just be the people who have interests in fish and managing the river for fish. There would be water budgets associated with each of the flows. So what do I mean by a water budget? I just talked about some very specific flow regimes, both for base flows or year-round in-stream flows, as well as channel maintenance flows. What we did was we actually just added up that volume of water for base flows. It totals to about 24,000 acre-feet of water and change. So what we've done is we said as long as you stay within that volume of water, the committee will have the ability to tinker with the flow regime. And they could potentially bank water into subsequent years to have more water available in subsequent years and maybe less water if they use less water in a previous year. Same thing for channel maintenance flows. It's about 3,000 acre-feet of water over that 10-year period. But how would they be making those decisions? Well, we're going to have a monitoring program. Really what the project owners are committing to is a funding commitment for monitoring. The only thing we're being prescriptive about is flow meters, which would be built into the infrastructure itself, right? We're committing to providing a specific amount of water, so we want to make sure we're providing that amount of water. And then other than that, we've just provided some recommendations on what we think would be appropriate monitoring efforts, including continuation of the adult salmon surveys, reporting winter water temperatures, measuring sediment grain size and spawning reaches, and then assessing straying impact from the tail race. I'll pause here and I'll talk about that for a second. So why this is probably the first time I've mentioned straying rates. Like I said, Fish and Game is currently stocking the tail race out by the powerhouse with Chinook and Coho. The fish that are returning to the tail race actually have to swim by the mouth of the Akutna River first. So if we start putting water down back into the Akutna River, we will actually have the same water going to two different locations. And the fish that are trying to return to the tail race might sense the water coming out of the Akutna River and make a right turn up into the Akutna River instead of returning to the tail race itself. So we anticipate that there will be some amount of straying occurring of tail race fish into the Akutna River. And this could result in a ultimate reduction in the number of fish that return to the tail race, which could be an impact to recreation. Is again, it's one of the eight things the governor is required to consider as part of the Fish and Wildlife Program. Unfortunately, we can't quantify that straying rate now, but we will be able to quantify it later. So we've put in a commitment to do that as part of the monitoring program and then evaluate appropriate mitigation measures after that. But ultimately, the committee will have the ability to decide what kind of monitoring efforts occur. It's, again, a more of a funding commitment from the owners in order to fund that monitoring effort. And like I said, all those monitoring results will feed into an adaptive management strategy where the committee can request alternate flow regimes, but as long as you're staying within the water budget itself. Okay, so I had talked about new bridges for AWU and why. Why are we building bridges? We thought we were talking about a hydro project. Well, the answer is that if you remember, I talked about how the buried pipeline is buried for about 6 miles underneath the Akutna River before it pops out of the valley and goes to the water treatment facility. there's actually an access road that parallels or is on top of or immediately adjacent to that pipeline for all 6 miles. The access road crosses the riverbed 10 times. The first two crossings leading to the A-Report valve itself actually already have bridges. And this is a photo of one of those AWU bridges. You can see this photo was also taken during our 2021 study flow releases. So there is water in the river in this picture, but under current conditions, there actually is no water in the river right here. The other 8 crossings are currently ford crossings, meaning you just drive through the dry riverbed itself. If we're going to be putting water back in the river year-round, then AWU still needs to be able to access their infrastructure. So part of our program will be building 8 new bridges for AWU so that they can continue to access their entire pipeline, even with water in the river year-round. So in addition to that, we've been coordinating with AWU throughout the design of the AWU portal valve option, and we've included a bunch of engineering measures in our design to make sure that we're addressing any and all of their concerns regarding potential impacts to the public water supply. Our proposal does not impact AWU's water rights, so they can still draw up to their maximum water right of 41 million gallons per day. They do not currently draw that much. They currently draw about half of that. But even if they were to start utilizing their maximum water right, this would not impact their ability to do so. Like I said, constructing 8 new bridges, and then other stuff that has been included, those engineering measures I was talking about, include a new isolation valve structure, replacement of an outdated communication system, and new redundant flow meters. And all of that totals to about $7.3 million of improvements that benefit AWU.
So, Ms. Owen, $7.3 million, who gets the bill?
So this is included in the project owner's program, so it will be part of what the project owners are paying for. AWU would not be paying this $7.3.
Representative Shragi has a question.
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair, Representative Shragi, for the record. So would that mean that some of that cost would be borne by or need to be require appropriation from the Anchorage Assembly? Is the Anchorage Assembly one of the project owners?
The municipality of Anchorage is one of the project owners, and there is a cost sharing. Well, there are various cost sharing agreements amongst all three owners on how this is divvied up.
Representative Shaw, you follow up?
Yeah, thank you, through the chair. I think that was a yes, but
I guess the clarification I made is that the municipality is the owner. I wouldn't necessarily classify the Anchorage Assembly itself as an owner, but that. That helps to clarify.
Shall you follow up?
Yeah, follow up. Thank you. Would it require funds from the municipality that would require appropriation by their legislative body?
I believe the answer is yes, but I will actually pitch to Julie or Andrew or Tony if you guys have any additional information that you want to provide regarding that question.
So, would you please put your name on record and give us your affiliation if you would like to comment? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. This is Julie Haskett from Chugach Electric, and yes, I believe Samantha is correct. The MLA is the owner, and the Assembly is the body that appropriates money. There is a taxpayer impact as well as a ratepayer impact to MEA and Chugach.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. If there's no other, any other questions from the committee members? Please, Ms. Owen, please continue your presentation.
Okay. And I will talk more about costs of the program as a whole in a later slide.
Okay.
Oh, it's this one. There you go. Perfect. Very timely. So what does all of this cost? I'll skip straight to the punchline. That $7.3 million was just improvements that would benefit AWU. The total cost of the program is about $57 million, and there's a lot of stuff that goes into that. First, it's the CapEx, the capital cost, and that in and of itself is about $15 million. Then we have the increased O&M on a yearly cost is about $300,000 and change. And then we have the replacement energy cost, which is about $1.3 million per year. Again, this goes back to the fact that Acuña Hydro is currently the lowest cost energy source, and so replacing it, any amount of water that goes down the river is lost generation and needs to be replaced with something else. So this is the cost of that lost generation. There's also the monitoring program funding commitment that I was just talking about is included in that cost. You add it all up, and it has an annualized cost of about $3.5 million per year, and that's how we get the $57 million over a 35-year program. How that impacts ratepayers and taxpayers, it's a 0.67% increase for rates for Chugach, approximately, and then about 0.87% increase in rates for Matanuska Electric, approximately, and a 54-cent tax impact for $100,000 of property value for MOA taxpayers. You can also think of that as mills if you talk in mills. Oops. There we go. Okay, so that's what was included in the draft program, and now I'm going to go through what was not included in the draft program and why. I've tried to summarize it as best as I can here. There's a lot of information on the screen, so I'll go through it slowly. But why aren't we releasing higher flows from the AWU portal valve? Well, that goes back to the in-stream flow study that I was describing earlier and how 40 CFS falls right at the inflection point. Higher flows might give you marginally more habitat, but the incremental gains in habitat are minor when compared with the increased costs of that replacement energy. So that's why we're proposing the 40 CFS in this work. Why aren't we proposing year-round flow releases from the AWU pipeline? Well, this is the first time I've mentioned that, so what am I talking about? One of the alternatives that was evaluated as part of our study program and in the alternatives analysis was actually releasing water from farther down in the AWU pipeline. The idea here was to avoid any potential impacts to AWU's access road and the need for those new bridges. Long story short is that you get far less habitat gains, but it still costs the same. So it doesn't really make sense from a cost-benefit perspective. We also looked at the potential for a new bypass tunnel. So instead of using AWU's existing tunnel, we thought, why don't we just drill our own tunnel? Long story short here is that it's a much higher cost, and you still get the same habitat gains. So this also did not make sense from a cost-benefit perspective. Then this gets into some of those other categories, those other buckets that you saw on the figure from earlier in the presentation, where people's preferred alternatives were falling into, three or four different buckets. One was year-round flow releases from Acuña Dam, either with or without a fish ladder. Why aren't we proposing that? Well, in order to release water from Acuña Dam year-round, the reservoir would have to be held high so that there is water at Acuña Dam year-round. If you remember, we currently draw the reservoir down every year, and under this scenario, the owners would no longer be able to do that. And so we would fundamentally be changing the hydro project from a storage project to a run-of-river project, which means you would only be able to generate in the spring and summer when inflows to the reservoir are occurring. You would actually have to turn the powerhouse off about 7 months throughout the entire winter, and you would not be able to generate during that time. Otherwise, you risk drawing the reservoir down so low that you can't release water from the dam to the river for fish. So this is why we're not proposing that as part of our program. There was also a replacement dam concept that we looked into as part of the alternatives analysis, and this was trying to thread that needle so that we could continue to release water from the existing dam location and water all 12 miles of the river and allow fish passage into the lake, but also allow the owners to draw the reservoir down when they need to so that they could generate year-round. The solution would be to remove the existing dam completely, dredge down about 10, 15, 20 feet or so, and then put a much taller dam in its place. And then that way we could connect the lake and the river at a lower elevation. Theoretically, this could work. However, it was by far the most expensive option, and it still decreases the reservoir storage capacity by about 40%. So it would work in an average water year, but it would not work in a not average water year, right? And I can go back to another slide to maybe explain that better. But the last thing we looked into, and this really should be several different buckets of categories, but overall, looking at fish passage into the reservoir, in addition to the concerns associated with both releases from the Kootenai Dam and putting in a fish ladder there, and the replacement dam and that including a fish ladder, other concerns on top of that regarding viability of the habitat in the lake for rearing salmon, the effectiveness of downstream passage. So it's not just upstream passage getting the fish into the lake. It's also having to get the fish back out of the lake and into the river. Long story short is we looked at several different ways to try and make that happen. And currently we haven't found a solution that would be what I would call effective. So we haven't found an effective downstream passage solution yet. We also, as part of our study program, looked into IHN and that existing Okami population. If you don't know what IHN is, it's an infectious disease that's common in sockeye salmon, but it can also be spread to other salmon populations like Chinook or Coho. If we were to connect the river to the lake, there was a concern raised by some other stakeholders about amplifying the IHN that already exists in that Kokanee population and having it spread to other salmon populations that would also be utilizing the lake or the tailways where that water would be discharged. And then also potential impacts to water quality was a concern raised by ARU. So currently, obviously, that's 90% of the public's or the city of Anchorage's public water supply. There's a very low biological mass in the lake, right? There's not a lot of fish there. And the water treatment facility is built around those current conditions. If we were to increase the biologic loading in the lake, ARU would likely have to increase their filtration of the public water supply in order to meet water quality standards. So in summary, our current proposal, we believe, will benefit all four species of salmon that are currently spawning in the Akutna River, providing habitat in 11 out of 12 miles. It achieves 96% of the max spawning habitat, we believe, for Chinook, below the ARU portal valve, 99% for Coho. It allows for adaptive management to improve habitat over time. It maintains Akutna Hydro as a year-round resource, especially during the winter months and during cold snaps or cold spells, and I'm going to talk more about that here in just a little bit. It protects the public water supply. It indirectly benefits the wildlife that depend on the salmon. It avoids impacts to recreation. Some of those other alternatives I was just talking about have their own impacts to recreational resources, either requiring increased reservoir levels, which would have increased erosion of the lakeside trail, or other impacts like having to dredge out the land where some of the existing public use cabins are in the state park. The current proposal minimizes costs to ratepayers and taxpayers. It minimizes increases in carbon emissions, and we believe it achieves an equitable balance of costs, benefits, and impacts. So that program went out in October, and we received a lot of comments on the draft program. All the comment letters that were received from the signatories to the 1991 agreement, as well as Akutna Inc., are available on the project website if you want to go read any of them in detail. We then proceeded to meet with the signatories and the Native Village of Akutna in December of last year to attempt to resolve our differences. Those discussions centered around a lot of stuff, including flow release location, flow regime and water budget, water banking, physical habitat manipulation. So that would be actually going into the river and physically manipulating the habitat itself with either boulder clusters or engineered log jams, things like that. The fixed wheel gate. So this is an option where we would actually demo out the existing overflow spillway and we would instead put a fixed wheel gate in its place. This would give a lot more control over future spill events. fish passage, climate change, how that's going to impact inflows to the reservoir, how much water is available for release, lakeside trail repairs, again, going back to erosion, some erosion that's currently happening along the lakeside trail due to reservoir operations, monitoring efforts, you know, what monitoring efforts are appropriate, what the specific success criteria for each of those monitoring efforts would look like, who would participate in the adaptive management committee, and then ultimately dam removal. So the native village of Aputna, their preferred alternative at the end of the alternatives analysis was the replacement dam option. But per the letter we received from them in November, they have updated their preferred alternative to be removal of the dam or project in 10 years after replacing it with another renewable energy source. We received a lot of the public comments we've been receiving have revolved around this topic, and so we wanted to provide some initial thoughts regarding what dam removal might mean. So first, when we're talking about replacing Aputna Hydro with another renewable energy source, it has to be a firm renewable energy source. I'm sure you guys are probably aware that wind, solar, and run-of-river hydro are not considered firm energy sources. They do not count towards capacity reserve requirements. So in order to replace Aputna with a firm renewable energy source, we would be talking about replacing it with another storage hydro project. And in order to identify, study, license, design, and construct a new hydro project or projects of the equivalent size would likely take more than 10 years. They would have their own environmental impacts, just in a different watershed. And if we're being honest, it'd probably be a pretty expensive option. This would ultimately set back the long-term timeline for the utilities of reaching their renewable energy goals. I know that there are a lot of discussions happening right now about trying to have more renewables, not less renewables, and taking away Aputna Hydro would actually just put a deficit on the starting line and would therefore take more time to reach those long-term goals. But what would the condition?
We have a question from yes. Representative Shragi.
Maybe just an observation, if I may, Chair Rauscher.
Yeah, an observation from Representative Shragi.
Thank you. Through the chair, it seems to me that we've known that we would need to resolve this issue since at least 1991, and it seems to me that we've had more than 30 years to start planning for replacement generation. So just an observation that while it would take likely more than 10 years to find an alternative, we've had more than 30 to do this planning, and it seems to me a major failure that we have not. Thank you.
Any more, if you would like to comment, otherwise I'll ask for any more questions.
I was just going to say that I think just to clarify, the original intent of the 1991 agreement was to mitigate the existing project. We don't believe, the project owners do not believe the intent of the agreement was to remove the project or build a brand new project, but to instead mitigate the existing project. So I would say that we actually started 3 years early. Per the 1991 agreement, we really weren't required to start this process until 2022. Leading up to this, the project owners recognized that they would still need to meet the 2024 deadline for the governor to make a decision. That only left 2 years for the entire process, and recognizing that that really wasn't going to be enough time. So in order to allow for a really robust and comprehensive process and study program, they started over 3 years early, and which is why we've now been working on this for the better part of 5 years. But I don't think I would clarify it as saying that the original intent of the 1991 agreement was always to remove the dam, because I don't believe that is was the intent.
Follow up, Representative Shragi.
Yeah, thank you. This time a question. Isn't part of the reason that we have the 1991 agreement, the Fish and Wildlife Agreement, to mitigate the impact on red salmon? Red salmon?
Sockeye salmon, red salmon are mentioned specifically in the divestiture summary report that went to Congress in 1992. but the 1991 agreement itself does not specify a specific outcome. It is very much a process document. It outlines a process that the project owners must go through. It does not specify a specific outcome that they must achieve.
Thank you, Chair Rauscher. And last follow-up through the chair. So I guess my question would be if it's mentioned that sockeye salmon are part of what we're attempting to mitigate, or that's a foundational reason why we have this Fish and Wildlife Agreement, I understand that it did not specify the outcome that would be required as of all of this, but it seems to me, given that the sockeye rely very heavily on the lake to be able to spawn, that really just from a common sense approach, you would foresee the need for the removal of the dam. Am I wrong to think that while the outcome wasn't specified, that a logical conclusion, if we're going to mitigate the impact on red salmon, would be to remove the dam?
I think we looked into several different fish passage options, which would have achieved the same kind of connectivity goal that you're describing, right, of getting the sockeye into and out of the lake. And the project owners did evaluate all of those. We evaluated everything that anyone proposed as part of this process, now including dam removal. So I don't think it would be right to jump to the conclusion that you would need to remove the dam as part of this project.
Thank you.
Ms. Sohn, I'm going to leave the room for 4 minutes, and I'm going to turn the gavel over to Tom to continue the presentation, and I will be back in 4 minutes. Thank you.
Okay, Ms. Owen, Vice Chair McKay here. Please continue with your presentation.
Great. So other thoughts on dam removal, right? What would it actually look like in the river, and what would some of the downstream impacts entail? If we did not have the dam or the hydro project, then flows in the Acutna River would look pretty similar to a natural flow regime. And I'm going to caveat that by saying, A, we would still be drawing water from the reservoir under this scenario. But again, only 10% of the water is going to AWU, so it would look very similar to what a natural flow regime might have looked like in the Acutna River. And that entails about 1,200 CFS in the river every July and August, and about 2,000 CFS in the river every few years in wetter water years, and then every 10 years you would see something like 4,000 CFS in the river. We were able to make these statements because we were able to back calculate inflows to the river over the last 20 years. That was part of the process when we were developing the operations model. So we know what the inflows to the river have been in that time frame, inflows to the reservoir have been in that time frame, even though it's not gauged directly. With that amount of water in the river, there are some concerns regarding downstream infrastructure, specifically AWU's buried pipeline. So again, that pipeline is buried for about 6 miles, either directly under or adjacent to the riverbed. When you start to see multiple thousands of CFS in the river, there's a significant risk of scour impacts to the pipeline, and that's a concern that AWU has raised with us directly. The hydro project owners also have their own agreement with AWU that dates back to the 80s when that infrastructure was built. And per that agreement, they legally cannot do anything that would negatively impact the public water supply. So when we are evaluating dam removal, this is obviously something we're going to really focus in on and make sure we're considering all the potential impacts to that public water supply infrastructure. But other potential impacts to downstream infrastructure, we have those bridges downstream, including the downstream railroad bridge and the downstream highway bridges. Those bridges would likely be impacted by the project, and we are currently having discussions with DOT and the Alaska Railroad to further analyze what those impacts might be. And all of this is going to be summarized in a more detailed assessment of dam removal, which will be included in the proposed final program that goes to the governor in April. So the very last thing I was going to hit on was, and I'm actually going to pitch to Tony Zellers with NEA to talk more about this, It was the recent cold snap that was experienced in South Central Alaska and the importance of the Kootenai Hydro in mitigating and managing that cold snap. So Tony, do you want to speak to this slide?
Sure. Thank you, Samantha. Through the chair, for the record, my name is Tony Zellers. I'm the Chief Operating Officer for Matanuska Electric. First, I want to thank the committee for having us here, but I wanted to talk a little bit about this most recent cold snap that we had and how valuable the hydros are. They tend to get lost in the discussion when they're talking about gas, but when NSTAR puts the utilities on notice that there's a potential gas supply issue, as they did, while NSTAR is still in their green status, one of the first steps that the electrics take is we move to maximize our hydros. And you can see some of the numbers there before the cold snap. We started at 13% hydro, and during the cold snap, we increased it to 23%. What did this mean for including the hydro? When we maximize the hydro plant's a 40-megawatt plant nominally. From January 31st to the end of November 4th, Kootenai Hydro ran at max output except for maybe 3 or 4 hours. That's 40 megawatts every hour or 960 megawatt hours per day. What did that save us? For MEA, that saved over 27,000 MCF during this cold snap. It's hard to value a storage hydro, but it really kind of comes out when you have these cold snaps. And I'd like to turn it to Andrew Laughlin for Chugach Electric to give Chugach's perspective on this.
Good morning, and through the chair, for the record, my name is Andrew Laughlin. I am the Chief Operating Officer for Chugach Electric. And a lot of what I'd like to do is kind of echo some of Tony's comments there. For a utility like Chugach or MEA, we're primarily natural gas-fired utilities. For Chugach specifically, we get about 15% of our generation through hydroelectric plants on an annual energy basis. However, during peak times, we can push that to about 25% of our peak generation to come from hydro projects. And so that's the 23% number you see there is between Chugach and MEA. That's a really important point for us and then very valuable, especially in the cold snaps that happened, for example, last week. And Kootenai can meet up to 8% of Chugach's generation alone or peak demand during these times. And it's a very valuable resource to have in those situations. And like Tony said, that offsets a huge amount of natural gas. In those situations, I think we're looking around 60,000 MCF for Chugach alone over the last that time period in question. And also, it's a dispatchable resource, so it has a lot of flexibility for us to call upon it whenever it's needed, and we can use it at any time at its full output. So that's all the comments I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Andrew.
I appreciate the comments from the utilities. Owen, we have a couple questions. I'm going to let Representative Armstrong go first, and then we have one from Representative Shragi.
Thank you, through the chair. I'm just thinking about if we had an extended cold snap. You talked about going to max capacity. At what duration can you be at max capacity?
Yeah, I will pitch that to Tony Zellers with NEA.
Thanks. Through the chair, Representative Armstrong, it really depends on how much water we have ponded in the storage hydro of how long we could to go to max capacity on this lake. We probably had another 2 to 3 weeks that we could potentially have ran it at least for MEA at our max capacity, as we had not a lot of water carried over from December, but we had probably 9,000 megawatt hours carried over from that time frame.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Shragi.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Rauscher, through the chair. So we had NSTAR here before the committee recently talking about their green, yellow, red scale for home heating and, you know, our response to the cold temperatures we had. Had we done a better job of educating the public around the need to be able to respond in that way to a cold snap, how much, you know, we talked about Aklutna hydroelectric being ramped up, saving us 60,000 MCF during this most recent cold streak. Do we have any sort of approximation as to how many MCF we would have saved had the public responded by reducing their thermostats to 65 degrees?
Thank you. I'll, again, pitch it to Tony to answer that question.
Thank you, Representative Shoggy, through the chair, Tony Zellers. We don't have any current numbers from that. If you remember back 2009, 2010, when we went through an energy crisis, NSTAR did do a test with the public on that. And at that time, because it was probably a test, it was probably one of the reasons, but it was very nominal of what the gas was saved. So from that, so it looks like Julie may have a response too.
Ms. Haskett, were you wanting to comment?
Well, if I may, through the chair, to just help answer.
Please put your name on the record to identify yourself, and then feel free to comment.
It's Julie Haskett from Chugach Electric. And to Representative Shragi's question, like, we were sort of following the lead of NSTAR. You know, we were talking daily, waiting to see if they wanted to go to yellow. But since they are primarily a gas company and the electrics have other tools, such as our hydro and even diesel if necessary, we were just waiting for them to take the lead on the messaging. But we were all talking daily and just trying to be coordinated. I recognize your question, and I heard your concern yesterday. But that's kind of what was playing out during the cold snap. I hope that makes sense.
Representative?
Yes, I guess a comment. Thank you, Chair Rauscher, through the chair. You know, I think we should be exploring all of the options when we look at how to meet our energy needs here in South Central, including making sure that we do proper education. And I know this doesn't go to Chugach Electric or MEA, but this is maybe more towards NSTAR. You know, I think to the extent that we can mitigate the need to ramp up our hydroelectric because we have the population responding accordingly, that would be beneficial. I don't think that we should be looking just to what utilities can do or what our maybe military bases can do to help mitigate the utilization of natural gas. So just a comment. Thank you, Chair Rauscher.
Thank you very much. Do you have one more slide, Ms. Owens?
Yes, it's just referring to our next steps. Thank you. And we are currently accepting public comments through February 19th. We actually had a series of public meetings earlier this year in January, and we are continuing to receive public comment for the next couple of weeks or so. And then once we have received public comments, we will review all of those comments, take them into consideration, and the project owners will put out a proposed final fish and wildlife program to the governor come April. Per the 1991 agreement, they are required to allow 60 days for the parties to the 1991 agreement to review and submit their own comments to the governor, so that's May, June. And then there is a 30-day comment period for the project owners to submit responses directly to the governor. We have allowed an additional 2 months on the back end of all of that for the governor to consider all of the information and make a decision by the October 2nd, 2024 deadline. And this, again, refers back to requirements regarding schedule from the 1991 agreement and the original transaction date for the project. And that is it. That is my presentation. Thank you again.
Thank you very much, Ms. Zell. Appreciate it. So we're going to do our part and go to public comment. And I'm going to take a brief at ease before we do. Brief at ease. All right, we're back on record. Right now I'm going to open up for public comment. And first I'm going to go to anyone in the room who would like to come forward and make a comment. Feel free if there is anybody. And I don't really see anybody in the room right here. So now we're going to go online First one online, we have Emily Cohen. Emily, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Ms. Cohen, will you please put your name and your affiliation on record and then begin your testimony? You have 3 minutes.
Yes, my name is Emily Cohen. I'm a resident of Anchorage, Alaska, representing myself. Thank you, Chairman and members of the committee. I'm testifying in support of a dam removal project alternative. The AWU portal valve alternative that was suggested by the project owners is insufficient to restore a thriving river and fish population in all parts of the Aquitna River and in the miles of habitat above the dam and in Aquitna Lake. The AWU portal is the least beneficial plan they propose as far as increasing year-round counts for all 5 species of salmon, both above and below the dam. If the dam were removed and the river was restored, it would be meaningful for people like myself to have a thriving salmon habitat so close to Anchorage. It would mean my family would not have to spend lots of money and time to travel down to the Kenai Peninsula or to Chitna to harvest salmon. And this would also be a meaningful opportunity for the state of Alaska to do right by our indigenous peoples, the native village of Aquitna, on whose land and waters the Aquitna Dam was constructed, without their consultation or permission, support a dam removal alternative. I trust the judgment of the people who successfully stewarded and cared for fish and wildlife in the Aquitna River for time immemorial over the biased determinations from the project owners, who conveniently chose the alternative that cost them the least amount of money. Removing the dam can occur after other renewable energy sources are in place. If the project owner's goal is truly to mitigate and address the harm their dam has caused to fish and wildlife, they must consider dam removal as an option. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you very much for your comment. We appreciate it. We're going to now go to Brenda Hewitt. Ms. Hewitt, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. If you guys can hear me.
We can hear you. Please put your name on record.
Great.
Affiliation and
okay.
Testimony. You have 3 minutes.
Oh, thank you so much. My name is Brenda Hewitt. I am the tribal administrator for the Native Village of Aquitna. And Chairman Rauscher and esteemed Energy Committee members, thank you for letting me speak here a little bit about the Aquitna Hydro Project and the 1991 agreement. The 1991 agreement was kind of a promise by the purchasers in order to kind of bypass all of the FERC requirements, that 30 years from then, they would look at ways to mitigate the impact. The Aquitna people, in fact, all of Alaska has been promised this. And I've grown up in Alaska all my life. I know that we have had a lot of promises from the federal government. Many of them have not come through the way that we thought they would. This just seems to be one more of them. And it's kind of frustrating when you're on the other end of it and you've been waiting for a long time for it to happen. The federal government asked the electric utilities to consult with the, you know, National Marine Fisheries, with Fish and Wildlife Service, and I think Samantha Owen from the Idaho firm of McMillan, you know, indicated that they have, you know, taken in all this information. What Ms. Owen failed to share with you throughout her program is that the utilities entered into a quote-unquote secret but binding agreement with AWU, the Anchorage Water and Wastewater Utility, to put in this portal valve or portal option. And so all of this research, all of this work that has been done over the last several years was for naught, because what they're doing is they're taking it and trying to figure out how it fits in with this agreement that they've already made. It is, I know that the assembly tried to get a hold of it. They were allowed to see it under executive session. But if you look at the 1991 agreement on page 2, number 3, in the very last line, it states that all studies, plans, data, reports, and comments will be made available to the parties and upon request to the public. We still have not seen this agreement. Evidently, it was done just outside of the timeline so that they wouldn't have to. I think that that's circumventing the process. So maybe the Energy Committee has enough power to be able to ask for that. It'd be nice to know when that agreement was signed and what it says. You know, they tick off the box marks, you know, and they say, oh, we have met with the native village of Aquitna, but they didn't listen to anything that we said. It's pretty disingenuous, and they didn't take any suggestions that we offered. Ms. Owen was saying that there were no sockeye in the river, and our staff saw them in and tagged them and reported this to them. They had them this year in the lower part of the river. So I just wanted to make that correction. And I also want to make anybody from the Native Village of Aklutna or Aklutna Inc. available to the Energy Committee for longer than 3 minutes, if you'd like it, to kind of give you some other background on it.
Thank you. Monsieur, can I ask you, were you speaking for yourself or were you speaking for the Aklutna Village?
I got permission from Aaron Leggett, who is our president, to speak on behalf of the Native Village of Aklutna.
I appreciate it very much for your testimony, and we will take that into consideration. I'm going to move on to Julian Ramirez. Ms. Ramirez, can you hear us?
Hi, yes. Can you hear me?
Mr. Ramirez. Yeah, I have a grandson named Julian, and I apologize. I misread that one. So, Mr. Ramirez, if you would, please put your name on record, your affiliation, if any, and begin your testimony.
Great. My name is Julian Ramirez, and I'm the Salmon and Clean Water Organizer at the Alaska Center. Thank you to Chairman Rauscher and esteemed members of this committee for the opportunity to speak today. Thank you, Ms. Owen, for taking the time to present. I'm calling in support of full restoration of the Aklutna River. This process has neglected public opinion and fails to acknowledge the benefits of introducing another salmon run in our state. The current plan does not reflect the recommendations of U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, National Marine Fisheries Service, or the Native Village of Aklutna, nor does it reflect the will of the Anchorage Assembly. In other words, it does not reflect those who represent the voices and the votes of the public. In a recent count of public comments on the Aklutna Hydro website, about 80% are in favor of river restoration. The proposed plan seeks to minimize costs while failing to address the potential benefit of revitalizing a fishery in the Upper Cook Inlet. An honest and accurate cost-benefit analysis would include all economic factors important to forming a decision. The Upper Cook Inlet sport and commercial fisheries are valued at $116 million, supporting 3,900 jobs. Salmon continue to be our fish with the greatest total ex-vessel value. I'm sure that you already know this, but it's important to remember, because salmon populations in this state are struggling. They return to us smaller in size every year, and we are currently watching the potential collapse of Chinook populations across the state. We have to do whatever we can to keep populations intact, which includes revitalizing pre-existing habitats such as Aklutna River and Aklutna Lake. As has already been mentioned today, this lake has been estimated to historically support up to 15,000 salmon without detection. This number does not include fish that died in the river, were dragged out by bears, or fished by Aklutna people. As has also been mentioned today, kokanee are currently in the lake. What has not been mentioned is that the only ADF&G record of fish stocking of Aklutna Lake pertains to rainbow trout from 1992 to 1996. Sockeye salmon ran this river in numbers so large that their descendants have survived for 100 years in a dammed and currently nutrient-deprived lake. Utilities companies have continued to push the misleading narrative that we have to choose between renewables and salmon. That is not the case. No one is calling for the immediate removal of the dam. We're simply asking to allow enough time for planned energy sources to come online before allowing the salmon to return to the river and the lake. The Alaska Center supports the efforts of the Native Village of Aklutna. Due to the dams on this river, they have experienced 100 years of cultural neglect. It's not too late to right the wrongs of the past. Thank you again for taking the time to address this important issue. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Ramirez, we have a question from Representative Fox.
Thank you, Mr. Ramirez. Chair Rauscher, through the chair, Mr. Ramirez. We did get some statistics that indicated that there wouldn't be that much improvement in the number of salmon, and you're challenging that as being inaccurate. Am I understanding that correctly?
Through the chair, yes, that is correct.
And your data comes, follow-up?
Follow-up, go ahead.
Yes, and you have data to substantiate that claim?
All
through the chair.
Put your name on record and ask the question.
Yep, Julian Ramirez, through the chair. Those numbers have been estimated by a co-author of the study that was previously cited, the marine nitrogen study, for potential based on lake size, turnover, and historical records of fish.
Okay. And third follow-up.
Representative, follow-up.
Could you send a link or the study to us so we can see that?
Mr. Ramirez.
Mr. Ramirez, sorry.
Julian Ramirez, through the chair. I would be happy to share some sources.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Any more questions, Mr. Ramirez? Representative Draghi has a question.
Well, Chair Rauscher, to the chair, maybe. I think that is a question that would be maybe best answered by the native village of Aklutna, because I know that they have historical records and practices, as well as it's my understanding that a large part of the reason that the native village of Aklutna is located where it is because of its proximity to these salmon runs. I don't know if there's an opportunity to maybe hear from the native village of Aklutna, but I know that historical experience and those historical records that they may have are important, and it might be good to get some context from them on that.
Brenda Hewitt, are you still online?
Yep.
Brenda Hewitt,
I'm still online.
Could you put your name on record and if you could answer Representative Shragi's question?
Absolutely, and thank you for the question. My name is Brenda Hewitt. I'm the tribal administrator for the Native Village of Aklutna. And yes, I think sadly nobody knew in 1929 that we should have been counting the fish in the river. And so it's hard to pull up data to show how many fish were here or what types. But we do have traditional ecological knowledge is what they call it. We have stories that people walk on the backs of the fish, that it was so thick. I mean, I don't think it takes a whole rocket science to figure out that the Aklutna people live in this particular area because of the plentiful fish that came. And you've got the Aklutna Glacier, you've got the Aklutna Mountain, you've got the Aklutna Lake, you've got the Aklutna River. It's because it was a thriving supply for food, and the animal life that was up there was, you know, also fed off of it, which, we have fish racks that people have recorded up in those areas. We have other communities, the Chickaloon folks and Kinnick have both reported having come through here and getting fish in trade with people from Aklutna. So we don't know the exact numbers, but we do know that there were plentiful fish here.
Thank you very much, Ms. Hewitt. Appreciate it. Thank you again. We're going to go. Any more questions? We're going to go to our last testifier online. That would be Cheney Fife. Can you hear us, Mr. Fife?
Hi. Can you hear me?
Mrs. Fife. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Can you put your name on record and your affiliation? I apologize.
Yes, that's just fine. I'm used to it. My name is Chenery Fife. I am with and speaking on behalf of Trout Unlimited. Trout Unlimited is an organization dedicated to caring for the rivers and the fish that Alaskan families depend on. I live and work in Anchorage. My coworkers and I work, live, hunt, fish, and recreate all around Alaska. Thank you so much for taking the time to learn about the Aklutna River and the issue around this. We do not believe that this draft plan meets the intent of the 1991 agreement. Trout Unlimited provided scientific input, reviewed field studies, and participated in more than 3 years of technical working group meetings. The draft plan that Sam describes ignores or misrepresents the input and recommendations of many of the members of the technical working group It also goes against what the Native Village of Aklutnat wants, along with many other organizations, community leaders, including the late Representative Don Young, and more than 1,000 local Alaska residents that would like for Aklutnat to be a fully restored river with adequate water and plenty of fish habitat. The utility's proposed plan is a very good example of throwing away good money after an idea that highly won't work. So in short, there is a lot more to the Aklutnat story, and I encourage you each to learn more about this. We'd be happy to share more information with you in following up. If we follow the utility's current proposal, we end up spending a lot of money on a river that doesn't support healthy salmon runs. We have better options than that, and if well done, this can be a success story. This can be a project that the entire state can be proud of. Thank you.
Anybody questions? Thank you very much, Ms. Fife. I appreciate your testimony. That concludes everybody that's online. Representative Prox has a question for the testifier.
All of the testifiers.
All the testifiers. Just
a request. If this presentation could be, I guess, boiled down to a few pages. Problem statement, what we're trying to do, and summary of the options. There was a little more detail. And then those that are encouraging removal of the dam, if they could write that down a few paragraphs as well, I would appreciate hearing from them. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Prox. Representative Schrage.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Rauscher. And to the chair, maybe a question for you. Is there some sort of legislative involvement in this issue? I know that the plan will ultimately go to the governor, but is there some role that the legislature has to play in this, or is this just for informational purposes and to help increase the awareness around this proposed plan? Can you shed any insight on that? I'm sorry not to know the answer.
Well, my understanding on this issue is that the legislature has no involvement unless the legislature wants to get involved. Okay. So we are not in the original contract signers. So we're not in the original agreement, my understanding. And those that are involved in this. And we are, we're just here to understand what's going on there, how it affects energy, how it affects the fish population, or how it affects life in general, and that's what this is about, so everybody gets a better understanding of what is going on there, because there's a lot of concern, whether they're on your side of the aisle, our side of the aisle, the other side of the building. So we just thought we would highlight it as one of our meetings that we're having here, and I thought it was a good discussion.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Was just curious.
Yeah. Thank you. And correct me if I'm wrong on that, Miss Owen. Am I correct? If you're there.
Yes, to the chair. You are correct. The governor is the one who will make the final decision on the final fish and wildlife program. And so we are here to provide information and keep you guys informed. My understanding that you guys were interested in the project.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your presentation. I do want to thank all those who are online. What? Oh, yeah. I got a close public testimony. So I do want to thank all those who are online. I want to thank all those who testified today, those who were answering questions. Appreciate the information. It gave us a lot more insight to what was going on. Since there is no more business before the committee, I will now adjourn us at 11:55.
Thanks, George.